Some important things that parish priests need to learn to do better today is multitask without being drawn and quartered, to wear many hats without losing a sense of priority and one's unity of life. For me, one of the greatest priestly witnesses of this is Bishop Alvaro del Portillo, who will be beatified in Madrid on September 27th. Born in Madrid in 1914, Don Alvaro, as he was called much of his life, was one of the first lay members of Opus Dei, joining at the age of 21. He had a doctorate in civil engineering, built Spanish highways and bridges, taught at the Madrid University. He also obtained doctorates in philosophy and canon law. In addition to this, he worked astride St. Jose Maria from the time he was ordained a priest in 1944 until he died 50 years later. St. Jose Maria sent him to Rome to establish Opus Dei there, and methodically he built an infrastructure while trying to help the spirit of Opus Dei, promoting the universal call to holiness in the midst of one's ordinary duties, to be understood in the Vatican. Thus, while serving basically as a vicar general, he was also consultant to various Vatican dicasteries. In 1963, Pope John XXIII named him to the Pontifical Commission for Canon Law, appointed him as the secretary for the Commission for the Discipline of the Clergy and Christian People that produced the decree on the priesthood, Presbyterorum Ordinis. And after St. Jose Maria's call to the Father's House in 1975, he was elected his successor, in which position he served until his own death in 1994, just hours after having celebrated Mass at the Cenacle in Jerusalem. Blessed John Paul II consecrated him a bishop in 1991. Cardinal Ratzinger said that he enriched in a singular way with his competence and experience the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith. To speak to us about his priestly life, his love for the priesthood, and very rich priestly theology, we're very lucky to have from California Monsignor Jim Kelly, who lived in Rome for 8 years, collaborated very closely with Don Alvaro for 5 years as he worked for the General Council of Opus Dei in Rome. Monsignor Kelly has civil and ecclesiastical doctorates in philosophy. He was the regional vicar of Opus Dei in the United States for many years, including during the time of the canonization of St. Jose Maria in 2002, and now serves at the Menlo Study Center at Stanford. Please join me in welcoming Monsignor Jim Kelly.
Presence this evening. I do think it's worthwhile. I was blessed to work there in Rome after my ordination 1982 for about 5 years after ordination, and it was really a privilege to get to know Alvaro del Portillo. I really appreciate the fact of being with him, in the sense that when I first began to work along with him, I was in my early 30s. And he really, by the time he was in his 60s. And I'm very grateful for the fact that he kind of anticipated difficulties I could have and really made it much easier to work. And always, he was always really a great source of support. And since his death, I really was convinced that he was a very saintly priest. And it's very gratifying to see, well, first of all, to see the miracle that was granted through his intercession. Probably some of you have seen the website of Opus Dei, because it's posted there. It was very remarkable. A woman had a child, and the child was, when he was born, I think they found some difficulty with the intestines, so they needed to perform an operation. And when the child was just a month old, they performed the operation and sewed up the child again, but then the heart stopped. So they tried for a half hour to get the heart going again, and were unable to do so. The doctor came out to explain to his mother, and his mother, as a good mother, she kind of spotted how the doctor looked. He said, "Is he dead?" So he said, "Yes." But she had the prayer asking Venerable Alvaro's intercession written out, and she kept praying. And then after they had given up, the heart started again, and is still beating today. He's about 10 years old. If you go to the website, they'll show a picture of him playing soccer with the other kids. He looks a little bit small for his age, I think, but really in good health. And then the announcement of the beatification was a wonderful thing. When I was here, I'm originally here from this area. I'm near classmate with Father Dave and with his older brother, Joe. I spent some years studying and working in New York, helping with the apostolate. But I think the reason for my being invited is that I did spend those years near Don Alvaro. If we want to understand his significance, I thought the best place to start would be that the actual day that he died. He was very, very close to the Holy Father because he had worked with him for a number of years. And so even when he was in Jerusalem, when he celebrated in the synagogue, the days that he was there, he sent postcards to all his friends, and he sent a postcard to the Pope, I think saying that he, if I remember correctly, that he wanted to be faithful even to death to the Church and to the Roman Pontiff. So then when he came back, he died that night, and they called the Holy Father about 6 in the morning, the secretary, I'm sure they spoke with the secretary to say that Don Alvaro had died, and they told him the circumstances. But that day he came by to visit, which is not a common thing in Rome for the Pope to go and pray where someone had died. So the people who were there at Villa Tevere, which is the central house of Opus Dei, expressed their gratitude. And the Pope, in his own manner, said, era dovuto, meaning that's the way it should be. You know, I needed to come. It was only right to come. And I think that's a good point to start from, to try to look back over the life of Don Alvaro and see, well, why? Why did the Pope regard this as being like a question of justice to go and pray near his mortal remains? It's good to go back to the beginning. My contact was really just for those 8 years, but probably it's good to give a little bit of a review of his life. Everything in his life, I think, can be summarized in just the three basic concepts of calling, his vocation, which he saw as a vocation to take part and to help in this work of Opus Dei. He met St. Jose Maria in 1935. Prior to that, through some friends of his, he had been helping out teaching catechism in a very poor neighborhood in Madrid called Vallecas. It's improved a lot, but it was a very poor neighborhood. There was a very strong kind of anarchist and Marxist domination of the neighborhood. And in fact, once when Don Alvaro went there to teach catechism, he was beaten up along with the other people who went there to teach catechism because the Marxists did not like the presence of the Christians there in this poor neighborhood. It was a very serious attack, and he only escaped because there was a subway station there, so he ran down and he just jumped into the subway car. The doors closed and they were still chasing after him, but they weren't able to get any closer. He said he thought that all that work that he did with the poor helped him to be prepared. So when he did meet St. Jose Maria in March of 1935, and then again when he heard him preach, which is July 7th of 1935, he reacted very strongly. He said the way that St. Jose Maria preached about the love for God and the love for the Blessed Virgin Mary, he was very moved. And so that very day they asked him if he would like to be in Opus Dei, and he said yes. And he always celebrated that day as a very important day in his life, July 7th, 1935. And he was grateful as well, which was very characteristic of St. Jose Maria, that his friends had advised St. Jose Maria, you should leave Madrid, you should get a rest. But when Don Alvaro asked the admission to be part of Opus Dei, he hadn't received much formation in the spirit of Opus Dei, and so St. Jose Maria remained in Madrid and spent time with him, and then with another person, was also one of the first three priests. Probably some of you are familiar with Father Joseph Musquiz. He and Don Alvaro and this Jose Maria Hernandez de Garnica, the third person, were ordained at the same time in 1944. St. Jose Maria had received a particular light from God. He was looking for people. And so he met an aunt of Venerable Alvaro, and she told him about this outstanding nephew that she had, as relatives often boast about the young people that they're a part of their family. And from that moment, St. Jose Maria started praying for this person. He didn't meet him, I don't think, for about 2 more years. The founder of Opus Dei, probably is familiar to many people, he received both a kind of inspiration which involved both ideas and an institution. The idea is the universal call to holiness, the idea of seeking holiness in the midst of the world, and then the institution was Opus Dei. So Alvaro was incorporated into that work, I think 1935 when he met the work. 1936 is the outbreak of the Spanish Civil War. They were all involved in a kind of turmoil. It's not a part of his life that I directly know much about, because he really rarely spoke about those things. I think I've only heard him speak about it once or twice on the occasion of protesting about some treatment of the Spanish Civil War that he had read in the news, in the press or something, and saying, we have to remember that there were many priests and religious who were killed out of hatred for the church during those years. But he never, apart from that, he didn't speak about his own personal experience. When you read the biography, you realize that he spent about 3 months in jail. It was very characteristic because of the antagonism. Maybe some of you have seen that movie, There Be Dragons, but one of the things that comes across well in the movie is that kind of antagonism. So people who are just, because they were Catholic, they were arrested. And he was in prison for about 3 months. He said once, when they interviewed him, he said once there was a man there who had a Russian name, Petrov or something like that, and he saw Alvaro wearing glasses. He said, "You're wearing glasses, you must be a priest." So he's going to shoot him. He doesn't know why he didn't shoot him. He just said, "No, I'm not a priest." He said once when he was there in this, it was like a school that had been made over into a prison, a kind of makeshift prison. So they took the prisoners once to the chapel of the school, and some guard took a cigarette and put it in the lips of one of the figures there in the one of the saints, and then some other person, one of the prisoners, got up and took the cigarette out of the saint's mouth, and they shot him. Well, I think that's the kind of extraordinary aspect of his life, but I think it's good to have that in the background. That was the life that he and Saint Jose Maria and many devout Catholics lived during those years of the Spanish Civil War. But the real point, and it's really what I'm more familiar with, would be, you could say, what does a priest do in terms of sanctification of ordinary life? And that's what I know more alongside him, although I don't know the part that comes earlier, which is a long period from the time that they went to Rome, which was 1946. 1943, Saint Jose Maria sent Don Alvaro, who was not yet a priest, he sent him initially to Rome to try to prepare things, because they wanted to get the permission for the diocesan erection of Opus Dei. So Don Alvaro went there to Rome, and that was not difficult. They got the diocesan permission, and then the Priestly Society of the Holy Cross was erected. And of course, that was the instrument that Saint Jose Maria had seen could be the means for having priests in Opus Dei, to have priests who would have the spirit of Opus Dei and could take care of the formation of all the lay faithful in Opus Dei. These contribute to it, the life of Opus Dei. At that time, Saint Jose Maria was just thinking along those lines, the Opus Dei itself. And maybe as an interjection, I could say, as years passed, there was a later point in 1949-1950. When Saint Jose Maria thought I should leave Opus Dei and start something for diocesan priests, and he was prepared to do that, but then as he thought about it more, he realized that this could be the instrument, this Priestly Society of the Holy Cross, this could be a way for people to understand the spirit of Opus Dei, share in the spiritual formation, and then that would be associated in some way with the spirit of Opus Dei. 1946, again Saint Jose Maria sent Don Alvaro to prepare the way for the universal approval, the pontifical approval for Opus Dei. So he went there and worked hard at it, and he was a very gifted person, a very, very great ability to make friends, get along with people. But they told him, one of the diocesan officials, one of the officials in the Vatican told him, "You've come 100 years too soon," which is not a very encouraging thing to hear. 100 years is a long time in the life of a person. So he used that as an argument to get Saint Jose Maria to come himself. So Saint Jose Maria came soon afterwards, and then they worked at it. And there was a general approval of Opus Dei in 1950. They were both involved in that. Now, Saint Jose Maria, and it's a background for Don Alvaro, Saint Jose Maria thought this is not the sufficient situation for Opus Dei, because he thought, and he turned out to be right, that the secular institutes would evolve more in the direction of religious life. I don't think this is going to work. But he accepted it for the moment. That was the best, that was the most adequate that was available at the time. But he always had that doubt in his mind about the situation. And so they were still kind of pending the work on that. At first, I think Saint Jose Maria thought that one of the other men might be able to work with him more closely. This is one of the other early vocations. Juan Jiménez Vargas was a very capable man, a doctor, a researcher. He's mentioned it a couple of points in the way, but it just didn't work out. It turned out, Don Alvaro used to say that he thought it was God's providence, that God worked things out so that he was the one who had the opportunity to to be close to St. Jose Maria for that reason. He said God had chosen him to work near St. Jose Maria. I think also I would recognize it as God's providence, and God's providence in the sense that he was such a capable man, it really was God's providence that he was the one who was able to work more closely with St. Jose Maria. St. Jose Maria would give him letters and instructions that he prepared about the spirit of Opus Dei and would ask his input. Blessed John Paul II once referred to St. Jose Maria as the saint of ordinary life, and that impressed me in Don Alvaro. He lived the small things of every day with great charity. He put great care into countless details. First of all, in dealing with our Lord in the Blessed Sacrament. Probably some of you have seen movies of the get-togethers with St. Jose Maria, and sometimes St. Jose Maria had a great gift for these question and answer sessions and connecting with people. And he had a way of making a point. So sometimes when he was up there talking to people, you have to remember these get-togethers took place in the years just after the council. There was a great deal of confusion, and he felt like a loss of respect for our Lord in the Blessed Sacrament. And so sometimes when he was up there in front of the people, he would genuflect. I mean, he's just talking with people in a living room, he genuflect, and he would say out loud, "Adoro te devote latens deitas." Now the thing that impressed me about Don Alvaro is that in all the years that I was with him, of course, many times you're with him, you see him genuflect, and he never said anything about it. He never said, "Every time I genuflect, I pray." But I'm convinced that he did. That he said something to our Lord every time that he passed in front of the tabernacle. It was never any routine, never any rush. And this was a person who was, I knew how occupied he was. He was a really busy man. He had great finesse in dealing with people and a gift for understanding them. I remember one incident, which is a very small incident, but I think the first few months when I was in Rome, when I was working in Rome there, I mean, it was kind of indefinite how long I was going to be working there. I think I thought at the time, well, maybe I'd be working here for good. And I think at some point I got a little bit homesick. In any event, one thing that happened in the get-togethers, like these after dinner sessions, getting together with the other people, there were about 20 other people who were living there. And people are just trying to be nice. So they would ask me about things that happened in the U.S. And one day, and really, the U.S. is a big country. So things happen every day. There are storms, and it's like things almost seem in conflict. You have drought in California, you have big snow in Chicago. So somebody came one day and said in the get-together, we were all together, that there was a big storm in Chicago and two people were killed. And I think I was a little bit missing the country by that time, and I was just fed up with these questions. And so I said, "It's a big country, people die every day." So Don Alvaro had the good grace of me not to make a big deal out of it, but every time after that, when anything happened in the United States, he would just ask me about how it was, you know, how this storm was or whatever. I suppose another thing that's related to it is that that years later, when he made the plan to come to the U.S., I've been living in Rome for a long time by then, but that was 1980. It was the year 1987 when the plans were being made. But when they made the plans, he asked me if I thought it was a good plan. I said, "It sounds like a great plan to me." He was going to go in January and come back in early March. And the other fellow who was with me, Father Michael Barrett, said, "It's a terrible time to go. You're going to have snow everywhere." It turned out all right. I think it has God's providence that it turned out all right. He made the whole trip without much difficulty. He had a nice sense of humor. Not similar to St. Jose Maria, with more outgoing person. He was kind of a shy person. Maybe one of the things that was most impressive to me in his life was, after he was elected, he kind of joked about that. He said, "You know, when I was young, and I was trying to think what I should study, I thought I should study engineering. Because I could study engineering, I could study law." He needed to make a living to support his family. "I could study engineering, I could study law." He said, "But I don't like to speak in public. I don't like to be out in front of people. I think I'm going to study engineering." So then he would kid about that when he was elected to be the prelate, because then when you're the prelate, you spend all your time in front of other people and talking to them, explaining what Opus Dei is, negotiating and so forth. And it was a tremendous change for him and a great loss, because he was so close to St. Jose Maria. But the idea that he just said, "This is God's will, this is what I should do," and that he did the best he could. One of the things he hesitated about, I didn't realize it until recently reading one of the biographies, because he didn't speak about that afterwards. But St. Jose Maria, as I mentioned, was very gifted for these large sessions with people. And sometimes if you've seen them on YouTube, they're very attractive. other people, when they analyze him, they're kind of amazed at how gifted he was for keeping the attention of people, keeping connected with people. And you watch him, you really see him as a man with a great gift for this. So when Don Alvaro was elected, he said, I don't know if I can do that. Maybe we shouldn't do that anymore. But he decided, well, that's what San Jose Maria did, so we should keep doing it. And he was very different in style, but he put his whole heart into it, and he really thought that was God's will for him, and he really did it as well as he could. An impressive aspect for me was his hopefulness and optimism, which I think makes him a good intercessor for all of us. It always seemed that the good possibilities, even in very difficult situations, which really stood him in good stead many, many times. One of the things that when I was reading this, I came across it, and I hadn't thought about it in a long time, and it wasn't really always something I was directly in contact with. But if you read about the development of the document, Presbytero Mortonis, it was very difficult. They worked on it for 5 years. And the Council of Fathers at first had the idea it should be something brief. So they came up with a scheme. They said, that's too long. And after some time had passed, they said, we want just 10 statements about the theology of the priesthood. So they came up with 10 statements about the theology of the priesthood. And then they brought the 10 statements about the theology of the priesthood to the whole body of the Council of Fathers, and they said, no, this is no good. We want a big document. So they were left with, I think, just a few months to prepare this big document. I mean, it's a funny thing about the way the church works. But you realize that he was very good in that sense of feeling, this is God's will. We just have to do the best we can. When they were finishing working, they couldn't work in the offices of the Holy See because they close. They close at a certain hour. You can't be there. So they found a place not far from Villa Tevere. It's that House of Sisters up at the top of the hill.
Right.
Remember that, where the people stay when they go to Rome? So they kept working there until midnight or afterwards for weeks to get this thing done. And they presented it, and it was accepted almost without disagreement. I think only 4 people did not accept it of all the people who voted on it. But it's an example of how difficult things were. You think of the other things that were accomplished in the time of Venerable Alvaro, his activity, and really there were wonderful things. One of the most difficult was the juridical situation of Opus Dei, which had lasted for so long. And I think he himself felt, again, with this idea of optimism. They presented it to Paul VI. Paul VI said, we should go forward with this. But then Paul VI died. They presented it to John Paul I, and he said, yeah, sure, we should go ahead with this. And then John Paul I died. They presented it to John Paul II, and he was very interested in it. He thought this should go forward. Because I think John Paul II, he had some contact with Opus Dei before he was elected, but that's one of the things that's very, very important in the life of Venerable Alvaro, was just his relationship with that pope. How did it happen? Well, it happened through a common friend. When they were all working in the council, a friend of Don Alvaro's, whose name was Carlo Descour, he died about 2 years ago, a wonderful man. When I was living in Rome, we used to have classes of formation at his house, at his apartment. Very, very, really a good man, good-hearted person. But he had a stroke just before the conclave. So he almost died, and you might remember the first day that Pope John Paul II was elected, he left the Vatican. He left the Vatican to go see a friend. Now it turned out that Don Alvaro had gone to see, now later Cardinal Descour, that day he went to see him in the hospital. The first time he saw John Paul II after his election was when they were both visiting Descour. Don Alvaro was getting ready to leave, and then they closed down the whole hospital because of security. And then Pope came to make his visit to Cardinal Descour. That's when they met again, because Cardinal Descour had introduced the two during the years of the council. And then from that point on, again, Don Alvaro knew the man, and he really saw the need to work, so he really made an effort. They were really very, very close, as is expressed in the fact that the Pope would come and visit after he died. I think I remember when the Pope first visited, of course, it was a big change to move from Poland. And I think, truth be told, where the faith is so strong and active in the life of the ordinary people, and you come to Rome, and Rome is a wonderful city, but you can't say the same thing about the life of the faith being so strong in the life of the ordinary people. And I think it was a kind of a shock. So Don Alvaro was very, very attentive to try to make him feel at home. So they helped him to get a rest, whatever way they could. I remember once, the very first year that the Pope arrived, I think they brought oranges. This is a gift on December 6th, because that's a traditional thing in Poland. So they brought oranges. He really tried to do whatever he could. And the Pope had various initiatives. One of the ones that I remember when I was there was the Pope, when he was in Rome, was in Krakow, he had the custom of having a mass for university students during Lent and during Advent. And he wanted to do the same thing in Rome. So he announced that, and he told the people about it. And again, to put it very straightforward, what happened was in Rome they printed up a very beautiful invitation, which is very characteristic of things in Rome. They're very artistic. But all the invitations were just sitting there. In other words, none of them had gone out. They were just sitting in different places around the diocese, but nobody knew that this thing was going to happen. So the Pope asked Don Alvaro, is there anything you can do? So Don Alvaro said, yeah, I can see what I can do. So there were a number of centers of Opus Dei there in Rome, and really it was kind of funny, because everyone tried to do whatever they could, even the students at Roman College. We didn't know very much Italian, so you can imagine us going out to try to talk to people about going to a mass of the Holy Father and St. Peter, try to explain ourselves as best we could in Italian. I remember one of the guys who was there going out and talking to a student, and the student says, no, I'm an atheist. The other guy did not speak much Italian either, so he said, ma proprio ateo, meaning, but really, an atheist? And the guy said, no, not really. Maybe I should go. Many other things in terms of the other trips of the Holy Father. One of them I do remember, and it always has struck me, because I was in Rome when the thing took place, was a visit of the Holy Father to Switzerland. And the people who had organized the visit, in a way, they kind of hijacked it. This can happen, whatever the bishop's council or whatever from Switzerland, they say, well, we're going to let the Pope know what we think, meaning we're not in favor of his way of approaching the things. So they had brought together a group of priests that they thought would be very dissatisfied with what the Pope was saying and would be willing to voice their objections. So the secretary of the Holy Father called Don Alvaro and said, this is what's happening, is there anything you can do about it? So again, they called one of the priests of Opus Dei from there in Switzerland, and he rounded up all the people he knew that he could, that would come, and they just went to the place and knocked on the door, and it was kind of a confrontation at the door about whether they should be there or not, whether they were invited or not. But they eventually admitted them. I think they felt that was a minimum of democratic respect for the other priests who were there. And again, the Pope was very, very grateful that they would have taken that effort, which was not an easy effort. I think, again, one of the things to say about Venerable Alvaro was he had this thought that really what you have to do is to count on the fact that the Pope is a vicar of Christ. What he wants is God's will for us right now. What he says, that's what we should try to do. And he did it with the right intention, even knowing that some people are going to complain, some people are going to object to what you're doing. Of course, I was there in Rome in 1981 when the attempt was made on the Holy Father's life. The only particular thing I remember from that occasion was first of all that Don Alvaro called that evening, or someone called in his behalf to tell us we should all pray, because there had been this attempt on the Holy Father's life. Later in that summer, he came and he talked to us again. And he usually went in the summer. Before he left for the summer, Don Alvaro, he would go to meet with the Holy Father and to ask his blessing. So he had gone over to the Holy Father and he'd seen him in the hospital and asked his blessing. He said, I could feel, because they gave each other like the kiss of peace when they arrived. I could feel that he was still hot. He still has a fever. So what he spoke to us about was, he said, I think people are giving the impression that the Holy Father has already recovered. He said, I don't think that's good. I think people pray more when they're alarmed, when they think there's some danger. Remember the Pope, after the operation went well, and he was recovering, but some of the bullet was left in him, and he got a very bad fever, and it stayed with him for a long time. So Don Alvaro, again, asked our prayers for him, which we did try as best we could to offer our prayers with that intention. They work very closely together on this topic, which I mentioned, of the juridical situation for Opus Dei. I think what we could say is that Pope John Paul II recognized in Opus Dei something that could be an instrument of the Church in carrying forward the evangelization of the world, and especially the formation of the lay faithful. So he really did what he could. He understood this. I remember one time Don Alvaro being very happy because he spoke with the Holy Father, and the Holy Father had the statues of Opus Dei on his night table. He would read that, so that he was really into it, what had been prepared. Well, I shouldn't skip over the fact of the Second Vatican Council. At the time of the Second Vatican Council, he was named an expert. He worked in several commissions, most especially, as was mentioned, the Presbyter Mortonis. I mentioned how difficult it was. There is a wonderful article, which is not included in the bibliography of what I sent you, but Cardinal Herons, who worked with Don Alvaro, he was on the same commission with Don Alvaro in the council, wrote a very beautiful article, which appeared in the early 1990s, about the image of the priest in the decree Presbyterorum Ordinis, which really sums up very well their work on it and what it meant in the life of the Church. One of the things that I think Cardinal Herons mentions is how Don Alvaro had the reputation of really being at the service of the Church and avoiding any partisanship. Another point that's mentioned in the, which I had never heard before reading the biography, but it's completely consistent with Don Alvaro's personality. Once during the years of the council, one of the other experts, Hans Kung, said some things contrary to Opus Dei, that he didn't like Opus Dei. And so one of the mutual friends mentioned it to Don Alvaro, and the next time Don Alvaro saw Hans Kung, he went up and gave him a very friendly greeting and said, look, if you want to know anything more about Opus Dei, I invite you to come over to the central house of Opus Dei. I'll introduce you to the founder. You can ask him any questions you want. I don't think anything ever came of it, but it was a wonderful gesture on his part. I think one that requires a kind of boldness was very characteristic of him. Praying the Divine Office, he prayed every day. I think St. Jose Maria provided that the prelate of Opus Dei, the person at the head of Opus Dei, the father as we call him, that there would be two people working with him, two priests, and in the years that I was there, I think they prayed the breviary every day together, and very constantly. They were very conscientious about that. One of the points you see both in Venerable Alvaro and in soon-to-be Saint John Paul II would be the importance of material life. I think we're used to the kind of dramatic things that we see in the life. Even you read the biography of George White, we mean the kind of dramatic things of devotion and piety. With Don Alvaro, it was a more simple thing in these small things of daily life. He had a great appreciation for the sacrament of penance. Once when coming back from speaking with the Holy Father, Pope John Paul II had said something to the effect, in Opus Dei you have the charism of confession. And Don Alvaro really emphasized that we should carry out this apostolate of trying to get people to go to confession. Sometimes he would say, if you want to have more vocations, you need to have more spiritual direction. Usually spiritual direction begins in confession, frequent confession. So in order for there to be more vocations in the Church, there has to be more practice of frequent confession. And he appreciated the relationship between confession and spiritual direction, also between both of them and proselytism. That was one of the things you could say about him. He really had a gift, this warmth in dealing with people, of bringing other people closer to the great mission of evangelization. He had a great love for Our Lady. During the years that they were working towards this juridical solution, he felt the first thing was a spiritual life. And so every opportunity that he had, he would visit a shrine of Our Lady and pray parts of the rosary, asking for this intention. I mean, he prayed the rosary every day all his life, but he would go out of his way to visit a shrine and entrust to Mary the work that they were doing. Sometimes at the end of the year, they would prepare a kind of photo book as a gift for Christmas for him, because it was the kind of thing that he would like. They just detail all the places he had been during the year. But we're talking about several places a week many times in the midst of all his activity. Spirit of penance, especially in accepting cheerfully discomforts. He was a person with a kind of not the greatest health. When both of them were living, many of the people in Rome thought that St. Jose Maria would outlive Don Alvaro, because he was sick a number of times, and at times very, very poor health. He seemed to have stronger health after he was elected to be the head of Opus Dei, but he did have the issue with his heart, which led to his death after he returned from Jerusalem. Personal meditation. I just remember one instance that really struck me at the time. I knew that Don Alvaro had a ceremony in the Vatican in the afternoon, so I think it was a mass that was going to be kind of celebrated for some reason. So I was expecting that would be what would serve as his time of meditation in the afternoon, because he had the habit of doing some time of meditation in the morning, some time in the afternoon. But when I went into the oratory early in the afternoon, for whatever reason, I saw that he was there just praying. And I realized that he wanted to do that because he thought he would get more out of it, that he would draw more from prayer if he could do it in silence, just praying by himself. When he was traveling, he couldn't read when he was driving. He would get sick. And I think there were several of the other people who were like that. So if he was traveling long distances, when he was driving around Europe to visit different centers, he would substitute for praying the office by praying parts of the rosary. He said since he already prayed three parts of the rosary, he didn't think it would be good just to pray the normal three parts. So they would pray, if they missed the whole office, they would pray three more parts when they would travel. He had a great Eucharistic devotion. He was so generous in pastoral activity. St. Jose Maria himself left an example of what he'd spoken about. He put in a graphic phrase, he said, all of us should die squeezed out like a lemon. And so St. Jose Maria himself was like that. I don't know if you ever have read, like there's a wonderful book which hasn't been translated yet into English. I hope it will be. It's called Memoria del Beato Jose Maria. And St. Jose Maria once, as he got to the end of his life, he was very reliant on the people with him because he was not in good health. So they had to bring him around to the places that he went. They had to help him to eat, had to help him get dressed. So on one occasion he said, I'm very grateful to you for all that you do. You helped me to get dressed, you helped me to brush my teeth or shave. Because, as I say, sometimes he was really quite weak. He said, but remember, I still have the same responsibility. I'm at the head of Opus Dei. If you see anything I'm doing that's not correct, please tell me. You can't have a false compassion because I'm not well. And he did die, I think you would say, squeezed out like a lemon. And Don Alvaro, I think, he had the conviction, that's what I have to do too. So he worked very hard until the very end of his life. As I mentioned, he sent a number of postcards from the Holy Land, one to the Pope, which Pope John Paul received a few days after his death. One thing I haven't mentioned yet, but I think it's important, it goes along with just the terminology that we've been using. St. Jose Maria had the idea that whoever is the head of Opus Dei should be called the father, that it should be like a big Christian family. And he had a gift for that himself, a kind of paternal spirit towards everyone, very great warmth. And Don Alvaro was kind of more shy, but you can see that he really went out of his way to live this affection for others. I remember one of the numeries here he lives in New York, Henry Menzies, but once he went to Rome for a kind of workshop, and he was just standing, because it was a big gathering of people, all the chairs were taken, and Venerable Alvaro saw that he was just standing along the side, so he took him over and brought him to sit down, and stood up himself. Part of the priestly responsibility is teaching, and Don Alvaro was so generous in his effort to teach all. That's why I was particularly grateful, because I was just kind of breaking into this work and living in Rome and so forth, and he was so attentive and so careful with all of us. Part of it is just generally what belongs to the role of the prelate. Usually every week the father, whoever he is, gives a class of formation for everybody who's living in there in that center, which is about 20 people. If it's a feast day, it means double work, more work than usual. Let's say Christmas Day, a very typical thing would be that the prelate will preach in the morning to the people who are there, probably 20, 25 people, or he might go to one of the different centers and preach. He'll celebrate Mass, then he'll go and have one of these large question and answer sessions with the seminary in Rome. Then he might go with the women who take care of the house of the seminary, have another session with them, maybe an hour and a half, and they'll come back, maybe do solemn exposition in the afternoon. It's like double work, and besides the normal work that he has to do, keeping track of the business and the kind of paperwork of being the prelate. The burden is really that burden of really being like a good father at the head of a family and having this concern. Some of the things I've mentioned in different biographies of St. Jose Maria, I'm trying to think of the things I mentioned. I remember one thing that, again, it was kind of a funny correction, but once when I was in a gathering with Venerable Alvaro, when I first got there, he just asked all kinds of questions. He and the other people were there just to find out who I was. So one question he asked when I was young, he said, "Where'd you go to grade school?" I told him where I went to grade school. It was a public school. He said, "Did religious teach there?" And I said, "No." Now somehow, the way I said no must have indicated I was happy that there were not religious who were teaching there. And that's actually the way I felt when I was growing up. To have women ordering you around, I don't like it at all. But Don Alvaro, as soon as I said that, he said, no. We always have to be grateful for the work that's been done by religious. You have to remember that St. Ildemir had a great love for religious. So he was always attentive to small things, like how you say things, how you look, how you come across to people and all the things that you do. Again, the hopefulness. Sometimes I remember Venerable Alvaro speaking about the situation of the church, and really you can see that he saw the things very, very clearly and all the difficulties, because the people write to the prelate and often they tell him their complaints, things that have happened, things that are not going well. So he's very, very aware of the situation, yet in spite of all the difficulties. Now I mentioned the other points in terms of his activity. Once, when he went to visit with Blessed John Paul II, the Secretary of State, at the time I think it was Cardinal Casaroli, had told him the Pope is very interested in anything that's being done in China. So Don Alvaro had prepared something. We had a small work that never really flourished, because actually it's very hard to work in China. They wanted to start a kind of corporate apostolate, but when they got to the point of negotiation, the government said, you can only do real proselytism with the people who are from outside China. You can't do proselytism. You can't try to talk to people about Christianity if they're from China. So that never went forward. But anyway, Don Alvaro went to speak to him about this particular initiative, this particular project, and at one point in the conversation, Blessed John Paul II pounded his hand on his fist on the table and said, what I'm really concerned about is right here. It took Don Alvaro a little by surprise. What does he mean, right here? And he understood him to mean, I'm concerned about how things are in Rome. And then they talked about whether it might be possible to begin an institute of higher learning in Rome. So this was 1984, I think, when they had this conversation. And that was when the initiative came for the Pontifical University of the Holy Cross. Which I mentioned it because it's like, Don Alvaro had a sense, this is what the Pope would like us to do, so we're going to do it, no matter how difficult it is. People wrote up a plan, because the people in Rome, maybe they have a lot of experience, and they're kind of serious about doing things, so they wrote up a plan, and they said, well, we can do something, we think, in 2 years. And so Venerable Alvaro said, no, we have to start this fall, because again, I think that's what the Pope wants us to do, something right away. So they did. Everything was mobilized, they found a building, they got the permissions to begin, I think, in the fall of 1985, which is, if you, I suppose it's the same in all the dioceses, but Rome is especially difficult to do anything quickly. Mm-hmm. And it really represented tremendous determination on his part, and to mobilize people from around the world to get the instructors for these programs that would begin. Well, I did bring these two books. I thought maybe you could take a look at them. This represents the work that he did. One over here, and then one over here. But I need them back, because you can't get a copy in English anymore. You can get if you're interested, you can get a copy, I think, in Spanish or Italian, but not in English. I couldn't find any when I was looking on the internet. I just found these in the center where I'm living. So the book about priesthood is just called On Priesthood. It's just seven essays about Presbyterium Ordinis, the human formation of the priest. The priest as described in the document Presbyterium Ordinis, the consecration and the mission of the priest, celibacy of priests, Jesus Christ in the priest, spirituality of the priest, the priest life as a dialogue with God and man. But those are books that he published in like 1970, just after he had finished. And it was a wonderful work that he did. I thought in preparing the talk that there's one point that I thought I would take a look at, which probably everybody remembers, is in some ways people treat it as being the most important point in the document. I'll just read a couple, the first paragraph is all. The Lord Jesus, whom the Father has sent into the world, has made his whole mystical body a sharer in the anointing of the Spirit with which he himself is anointed. In him all the faithful are made a holy and royal priesthood. They offer spiritual sacrifices to God through Jesus Christ, and they proclaim the perfections of him who has called them out of darkness into his marvelous light. Therefore, there is no member who does not have a part in the mission of the whole body. But each one ought to hallow Jesus in his heart, and in the spirit of prophecy bear witness to Jesus. So the first part is just about the fact that all the faithful are called to live this priesthood in Christ, to offer the ordinary things of life to God. And then the priest is the second paragraph. They have this special mission in terms of working towards that. The same Lord, however, has established ministers among his faithful to unite them together in one body in which not all the members have the same function. These ministers in the society of the faithful are able by the sacred powers of orders to offer sacrifice and to forgive sins. And they perform their priestly office publicly for men in the name of Christ. Therefore, having sent the apostles just as he himself had been sent by the Father, Christ, through the apostles themselves, made their successors the bishops, sharers in his consecration and mission. The office of the ministry has been handed down in a lesser degree, indeed, to the priests. Established in the order of the priesthood, they can be co-workers of the episcopal order for the proper fulfillment of the apostolic mission entrusted to priests by Christ. So the point I thought we could just touch on would be that was the let's say the ideal that's presented in the document, and I think Don Albert had the sense that's what I'm working on. That's the work of the whole church, but let's say Opus Dei, where I'm particularly working, that has a particular function and role in the church, which is to try to bring out that potential in the lay faithful, that ability to be like themselves apostles, if you want to say that. And Saint Jose Maria himself was very, had a kind of drive in that area. He would insist with all the people in Opus Dei, not just with the priests. You have to ask yourself every day, what have I done? And I think it seems like a long way when you think about the ordinary faithful having that idea, what have I done to contribute to the mission? Now, many times people have done that in terms of dealing with their own family or friends or things that they do at work, but many times they haven't really thought about it. And I think the idea, which is common, I think, both to Don Alvaro and to Blessed John Paul II, is the idea, if you want to improve that, you have to improve what's called formation. You have to have ongoing formation. You have to find ways to communicate to the lay faithful this idea of leadership, the sense that we all have to make use of the gifts that we have received. Now, he himself, he had the experience of having been a very prestigious person. When he first went to visit the Holy See, he was not ordained yet, and he was dressed in the costume of an engineer, which was like a military. So when he went into the Holy See, the Swiss guards all saluted him when he went in. When he went back to Rome, he told the bishop in Rome, I'm going to be ordained, and he said, Alvaro, you're going to lose your personality. Meaning, you know, you have a stature now, and you're just going to be one more of thousands of priests when you finish. He said, and Don Alvaro just said something like, I offered my personality to God a long time ago. Meaning that when he committed himself to Opus Dei, that was for good, for everything. Whatever happens, whether priest or lay person. But that's the idea, I think, that we have to take away from it. And I think especially the idea that the means or the principles are contained there. I think it's the conviction of both. Probably you've read, many of you, that book, Sources of Renewal. But what Blessed John Paul II speaks about is really like a consciousness or an awareness that has to be formed, has to be developed in people, and that was, I think, what Don Alvaro felt he was working towards, and really he was. He was a wonderful example. When I talk about him being willing to teach everyone, it includes all the priests who were there, but everyone. That all the people who took part in the means of formation, he had just a constant paternal concern for all the people that he met, would remember the things that he talked about, would remember their families. He kept up correspondence with people. Well, that's all that I remember about the life of Venerable Alvaro. I'm sure that I missed out on many things which are very important, but there will be, I hope soon, a biography in English. John Coverdale, I think, has been working on developing a biography. There was a long biography written by a priest I know there in Rome, Javier Medina, John Coverdale has been working with that, and I hope it will soon be available in English. So I don't know if there are any questions about...
Good time for questions.
Jim, what about the times when he lived with him? How do you see him living like a priestly fraternity with not just priestly work, but outside the work, like the ones in the Vatican or other places?
He had a wonderful reputation for a kind of availability. This was the years that I was there. Of course, he was already head of Opus Dei from the time I was there. It was really noticeable. I think probably what you would notice first would be how he put such affection into dealing with the bishops. that was at the first instance, because a lot of people who come to visit him would be the bishops, and that really did impress me. It impressed me on one occasion when I remember him. I wasn't involved in it, but one of the other priests there was from Germany, and he brought over four or five bishops from Germany, and they were all talking with Don Alvaro. But they didn't speak Italian, they didn't speak French, they didn't speak English. They only spoke German, and he didn't speak German. So it was like they would speak something in German, somebody would translate it to him, he would say something to them, back, and he spent with them, I'm sure he spent an hour. It's not easy to do things like that. I remember once when I was there, I happened to run into, I don't know if anybody will know about the background of this institute, but one of the people I ran into when I was in Rome was Carlo Hume. Carlo Hume had a kind of a little bit of a clash between him and Don Alvaro, because Cardinal Hume, back in 1980 or 1981, he published some indications about how Opus Dei should work in his diocese, which there was no real need for it, because one of the indications that was given was going to be part of the new code of canon law, which came out, I think, you know, just a few months later, and I'm sure he must have known that was the case. In any event, Don Alvaro, there had been a little bit of back and forth between them, but I invited him. I said, why don't you, could you come over for lunch sometime? So when he came over for lunch, and Don Alvaro, again, it was a little bit a similar situation. Don Alvaro didn't speak that English that well. Cardinal Hume did not speak Italian that well. So they both spoke French in the mealtime, but they just went back and forth. It was a normal meal. I remember in the evening how happy Don Alvaro was that Cardinal Hume had come by, because he made such an effort to be at peace with everyone. It was really a wonderful attitude on his part. And that's really most of the time that I saw him, when he was with people, he would be receiving bishops from different parts of the world. In terms of the priest, he did spend time, you know, giving talks and so forth. When we were ordained, I remember him showing us how to get up and down the stairs without tripping over the cassock. Really, he spent a lot of time with us. When there were activities for priests, he always took a special interest. When the juridical solution was granted, he said, now is the time when it's clearer that there's no confusion in terms of the priestly society, there's no double allegiance, it's more clear that the priests incarnated in the diocese just have that one relation, and that they can belong to the priestly society without any difficulty. It's time to give a push to this work. So he put a tremendous effort into developing it, and it did grow a lot during those years, beginning in 1982, you know, up until now. Other things about priests, he received priests with great, great warmth. And when he would go to these synods of bishops, because he was invited on a number of occasions, they knew him, and many times the other bishops who were there were asking him to go to confession, because he was a person I think even in his lifetime he had a reputation for holiness. People admired him. He did have this kind of, this great sensitivity. He would really try to be identified with the magisterium, but at the same time, he could work with anybody. And that happened also during the years of the council. The people had different points of view, and he respected everyone and dealt with everyone with affection, even though his own stance might not be the same as theirs. I don't know if that answers your question, but he did have a wonderful affection, wonderful concern for the life of priests. He dedicated a lot of his life to different things related to priests.
Is he buried next to St. Jose Maria?
He's buried where St. Jose Maria used to be buried. So St. Jose Maria, when he first died, before he was beatified, he was down in the crypt underneath the Prelatic Church there in Rome. So his body was moved up, so it's now under the altar in that church of the Prelature, and where he used to be, that's where Venerable Alvaro is buried now. I don't know if you've ever been there, but it's just underneath, it's downstairs.
I've always been impressed by just how much he was able to accomplish, little bit by little bit, in so many different areas. But could you describe the typical day that he would live, how early he'd get up, when he would pray, how he'd go to bed, this type of stuff?
He did get up early, but although I think it was partly because I don't think he slept that well. He did get up early. So sometimes there was an early mass there for some of the women who worked there in Villa Tevere, and sometimes the priest would be down there celebrating. Don Alvaro would come in early, so he would go back in the back of the chapel where he usually sat, and he would be, actually what happened, which also impressed me, was when he was there and he was celebrating the Mass, you could hear him. He would begin to answer the prayers of the Mass. I thought maybe he would pray the office or something like that, or do some reading or whatever. But he was a very devout person, so if you were celebrating Mass still, he would just respond to the Mass. So that would be about, I think the time of usual time for the morning prayer was probably 7:30. Pray at 7:30 in the morning. I don't know what he would have done before that. 8:00 he would celebrate Mass. Then he would go for a short breakfast. He would have, I think, time for praying the office would come first. I think that's what they usually did, where they pray the office the first thing in the day. Then they would have time for paperwork, which is very heavy, and it gets heavier. I really admire present prelate because it just grows. You know, if the institution grows, you have more papers. So it grows from year to year, and it was already substantial when I was there. It takes a lot of time. It was really a heavy burden for an hour. I don't think he really enjoyed it. I don't think anybody really enjoys it. At the end of the morning, he would usually receive people. He would receive people from, I think it might have varied according to the day, but he would receive people from about noon. And I do remember sometimes I would be there to translate for people. People only spoke English. And the pattern which had been established by St. Jose Maria was that the meetings are usually brief. So usually somebody would come by, one of the people who was there would come by and tell Don Alvaro 10 minutes have passed. And so Don Alvaro would usually say, okay, but we're still busy, so please come back. So he'd come back after 10 more minutes, Don Alvaro, Father, 20 minutes have passed. He said, okay, and then he would finish up. Because I think it was like a discipline that St. Jose Maria subjected himself to, not to go on too long in speaking with people, just have the meetings brief and try to come to the point. I was also very impressed that Don Alvaro was so much to the point when he talked with people that he would introduce himself, and he tried to be well informed. He tried to make sure he knew the names of the family and members and so forth, ask about different people in the family, but it was very much like a supernatural point of advice for this particular person. At the end of the morning, he would come down, usually spend a few minutes with us. Just before praying, we prayed some vocal prayers in Opus Dei, the Preces. That was about, I think it was happened at 1:25 or something like that in the morning, so we would pray together. He might give us some news from the day, which I think I always look forward to that, because he might have news that had come concerning the development of the apostle, whatever it might be, or news of the Holy Father. We would pray together, then we would go to lunch. After lunch, he would have just like a gathering, what we call a get-together. So it would be the people living in that center, which would be about 25 of us. We'd be there for maybe half hour, 45 minutes, just talking about the news of the day, people talking about different things. St. Jose Maria always had the idea, if you don't have these times of conversation with the people you're living with, there's not going to be that bond between them. You're not even going to know them. So his idea was we should dedicate time to that every day. So he would do that at noon. And then afternoon, I think it varied. Sometimes you have errands you had to go out to do, things you have to go and do over in the Vatican, whatever it might be. More paperwork, I think. Praying some more time of prayer in the afternoon. Finish the office. At some point in the afternoon, you pray the rosary. And after the midday meal, they would make a visit to the Blessed Sacrament. Then supper. Another time, and then more time of work, and then another brief time of conversation in the evening. Very, very, it was a very busy, very full day, along with occasionally making trips to different places and so forth, and just the work that he had. I remember when, one of the things I remember from the biography is that when somebody else took over for him at the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith, it was Fernando Acaris. He's now the Vicar General of Opus Dei. When somebody else took over for him at the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith, where being a consultant, Don Alvaro said to him, whatever they ask you, do it. Which I was very impressed by that, because he had enough to do already. I mean, to have people coming with requests. Once I remember in the 1980s, there was one of these things about public opinion. He was making a special effort to present Opus Dei to people in journalism and so forth. And he said, I understand the journalists. He said, when I'm working for the Congregation of the Doctrine of the Faith, they give you a material and they expect you to become an expert overnight. He said, that's not easy. And there's always something lacking, and that's what journalists are doing. You know, they have to become an expert from one day to the next. It's not easy to do that. So you have to understand them if they sometimes fail to get everything. That's the thing I remember about his normal day-to-day schedule.
he was prelate at a time in which St. Jose Maria was highly criticized by certain segments, especially leading to the beatification in 1992. Two questions based on that. How did he handle the criticism of St. Jose Maria? And then second, was he himself personally criticized, or was he more or less exempt from that type of stuff because he just wasn't controversial in the same way? He wouldn't have enemies because it'd make them his friend.
I think, well, one thing I think probably I think would be true to say that the reaction, in a way, I think he acted with a great rectitude. The norms for the processes were changed. I don't remember exactly the year for the new norms for the postulations.
Like 1983.
So the norms have been changed, and he just worked according to the norms that have been established. Now, the thing that took the people by surprise who were working in Rome was like, I think you mentioned about the talk this afternoon, but they would send a request for some information, and they would send it back by fax the same day. Now, that doesn't normally happen. The people who, like Fabio Cappucci, may he rest in peace, and others, I mean, they really worked very, very hard at this process. And then, you remember, one of the complaints was made, this was all too rapid. Mm-hmm. And I think that took him by surprise, in the sense that he was himself convinced this is a great saint. We're going through the process the way that it's indicated. We're just doing the work as well as we can, because that's the idea of sanctification of work, means you work hard, you do the things immediately. But people, it's not a common thing to just get back within hours sometimes of a request for more information. So I think he was taken by surprise. I think some of it was not that well, some of the complaint was not that well founded, in the sense that, I mean, one of the people I remember that they asked, they talked to an older cardinal who was always a very good friend of Opus Dei, but he was 94 years old, I think, when they interviewed him. And he just said all kinds of things, as people do when they get to be 94 years old. Mm-hmm. And they made it into a big deal, which I thought was really, disingenuous, you know, he's like not realizing that that's the character of human life. So I think he was a little bit surprised. He did what he could. I think actually the thing that I've always been very impressed by is that in the years afterwards, the present prelate, they had an interview done with the same cardinal, indicating that he thought it was all fine. Because I don't think he was that serious the first time when he made the criticism. Just people quoted him and made a big deal out of it. And then they went to the second person who complained was a woman who had been a member of Opus Dei years before. She made a lot of complaints about how St. Jose sometimes lost his temper. I think there have been a lot of saints who lost their temper, and I think really, if you didn't lose your temper about something, probably you'd not be very, very much of a saint. But they also got an interview from her, and she said she always thought that Saint Jose Maria was a saint. And I thought that was really kind of wonderful foresight in preparing for the canonization. I don't know. Don Alvaro was a very forgiving person. He would always say, you know, we should pray for the people who are involved. They're just doing it with goodwill. They probably think that this is something helpful for the church, but we just pray for them and these things will pass. I think he wanted to work in agreement with the Holy Father. I think he was very happy. I think it was a courageous gesture on the part of Pope John Paul II that he said we're going to go ahead, because there were these complaints that maybe it should be delayed, but he decided we're going to go ahead. The day that it took place, which was May 17, 1992, Don Alvaro, after the ceremony, said, when I saw the Pope this morning, he looked out over St. Peter's Square, because St. Peter's Square was really full. The people were there for the beatification. He said, now I understand why so many people wanted to prevent this manifestation of faith.
And Don Alvaro said that?
No.
Oh, the Pope said that.
The Pope said that.
It was a great day.
So I think he felt vindicated, you know, that this is, he's just doing what he can, doing what he thinks is the right thing to do. But I don't think he was ever... I think he could have been angry sometimes with the things that they said. I don't think he felt that it was fair, but it's still, he certainly encouraged all of us to pray for the people who are involved.
I'll take the last one. You were with him very young in life. If there are one or two lessons that have helped you in your priesthood from your time with Don Alvaro, what might they be?
Good question. Well, one of the things I remember most, which is just kind of a kindly gesture of Venerable Alvaro, was I'm sure 200 times when I was living in Rome, he would see me, and I might, for whatever reason, I might look concerned. He said, "You're too serious." I think that was a big help, actually. I certainly wasn't trying to be too serious, but still, I think it was a big help. And he was very like that. He was just like a father. He was not angry, and he was not like kneeling you that you have to change. But he was just saying, "I don't know, chill out."
Trying to be helpful.
Yeah, trying to be helpful. Is there anything else? Let's see. One thing, the other thing I do remember always about him, I remember him saying that when the young people saw, this is the way he put it literally, he said when the young people saw St. Anthony Maria celebrate Mass, he left them cross-eyed, meaning they were really impressed. I mean, there's a recording of one of these people, you know, one of the young men who crossed the Pyrenees with them, left a recording, a note saying, I took part in the Mass today like never before. I'm not sure whether it was just the circumstances or whether it was that the priest is a saint. But that's the way he looked at. I never saw St. Anthony Maria celebrate Mass. One of the details I think is interesting to tell, which I forgot to mention, is, and probably many of you are aware of this, but during the years after the Council, I mean, they made the change in the liturgy came immediately and kind of drastically. So St. Anthony Maria, when the change was made of doing the new rite, he struggled with it tremendously because he was very conscientious and he was afraid he was forgetting things. He was afraid he was doing the thing incorrectly, just trying as hard as he could. And he said after he celebrated Mass, sometimes he'd be crying. So I think Don Alvaro had spoken with him about it and he said, Don Alvaro, again, he was friends with everybody. He was friends with, and our father, St. Anthony Maria, sometimes kids him about that in the get-together. Go and talk with your friend Bonini. Now, it's not that they were close friends, but he got along with everybody. So one day when he went to talk with Bonini, he told him what was happening. And Bonini says, you can tell the president general, whatever, you can tell St. Anthony Maria that he has permission to celebrate by the old form. And Don Alvaro said, he told me I shouldn't ask for permission. So Bonini said, you tell him, you didn't ask for permission, but I gave it. So from that time on, he did. At the end of his life, he celebrated the Mass according to the extraordinary form until he died, which I think was a reasonable thing. He really suffered with it. Maybe he's an older priest, you know, he'd been celebrating this way all his life, and he put such devotion into it. But Don Alvaro himself, he didn't have any particular attachment. In fact, he kind of liked the variety of the new form and the fact of various options and so forth. He liked it, and he lived it very well. And I remember, I did see him celebrate Mass a number of times. And you wouldn't say this is a person trying to imitate St. Anthony Maria, but that from within, he had this real devotion. It was very beautiful to see him celebrate Mass, and that I think I do remember always, seeing the way that his devotion to our Lord and the Blessed Sacrament, I do remember that. I think that's a help.
Just on one last point, wasn't there an issue that when he worked in the congregation, weren't they saying just very disparaging things about St. Jose Maria and about Opus Dei, and Don Alvaro would have to go back every day but not reveal anything that was being said?
Oh, no, that concerns more things. It might be things that have to do with things being studied, you know, if somebody presented some kind of... I don't remember what I have to think about that. What was the case? But I think it concerned things that were involved his office. Mm-hmm. You know, what he was working on.
It was over that he might be taken out of Opus Dei.
Oh yeah, yeah. I think that may have been the case.
When they were
thinking about these various possibilities of reorganizing Opus Dei, that he might have known about it first, but he couldn't say anything to him about it because he that was one of the things that he was very, very delicate about. And I think he was kind of shocked that other people talk so readily about, because they do. People tell everything that happened in the meetings and sessions. But he really took that to heart. That was what happens there. You just don't talk about. So he would never talk about anything. Things that concern his work, you know, the studies that he did.
Well, thank you, Jim,
for this remarkable presentation.